Welcome, everyone. Bitcoin Optech newsletter number 413 recap. Today, we're going to talk about some research into using fountain codes that would let prune nodes help sync the chain. We have a couple releases, including Bitcoin Core 31.1 and an LND release. And then we'll jump into some notable code changes. And then we'll drill in a little bit on the mining IPC interface and some additional methods for Stratum V2. This week, Merch, Gustavo, and I are joined by one guest. We'll let him introduce himself. Shores, who are you?
Hello, I'm Shores. I work on Bitcoin Core with a focus on making Stratum V2 possible.
Awesome.
And some other things.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to jump out of order so that we can get to Shores' item sooner, which is down in the notable code segment, Bitcoin Core 34,020 mining IPC, fetching mempool transactions by ID. Shores, this PR adds two new methods to the mining IPC interface. I want to get into those, but I also think it would be useful to hear from yourself, maybe an update over the last several months about what's been going on in Stratum V2 integration, the mining interface. Maybe just, it could be high level, it could be we can get technical as well, but I know we're going to jump into like job declaration. Maybe you can kind of give us a lay of the land. What is the maturity level of the mining interface?
Yeah, so first I think it might be useful to explain briefly the difference between the IPC interface and the RPC interface. I don't know if you guys have covered that recently. But Bitcoin Core has had an RPC interface for, decades, a decade. And that's that's mainly sending commands and then getting a bunch of JSON back. And for small commands, like, give me the latest transactions of my wallet, that's fine. But if you're asking for a block template, now you have to take 4 megabytes of transaction and put it into a JSON object, and that's not very efficient. So for this and other reasons, the IPC interface uses something called Captain Proto over a Unix socket, and it's a much more efficient way to put data on the wire in a structured format. So that's useful for mining, but it's going to be useful, I think, for a lot of other tools too. And I'm especially thinking of indexers or Electrum server kind of application. So I think in Bitcoin Core, we've been trying IPC for mining specifically, but there are pull requests open to expand it way beyond that. And in fact, historically, it wasn't designed for mining. It's just that's the first use case that came in.
Sure.
So that's that difference. Then
can you quickly comment on other potential uses of IPC interfaces?
So historically, the idea was that Bitcoin Core wanted to split, and still I think wants to split, the node, which is just a thing that checks consensus, from the wallet, which is a thing to store your coins, but not everybody uses it, and the GUI, the user interface that's quite user friendly, or by 1990 standards, but does involve lots of dependencies, and again, it's not all users that want it. And so the idea would be if one of these stinks, has a bug or some problem, it crashes, doesn't take everything else down. So you split both the code, maybe in the same repo, but you split it somehow, and you make these three processes run as kind of like they're separate applications and they talk to each other. And that communication between these processes needs to be as efficient as possible, and that's kind of why Captain Proto was used. Yes, that is the backstory of IPC, I think, in general. So when it came to mining, a little bit of a history, which I think we might have done in an earlier episode, but initially, the idea with Stratum V2 was let's make Bitcoin Core support that. And that was kind of the original design in Stratum V2. It was kind of assuming that the Bitcoin Core node would be part of that ecosystem and it would speak this special language that was designed for Stratum V2, which includes encryption and certain messages. And the two, I would say, advantages of Stratum V2 are it's encrypted and it lets you make your own block template. And especially the making your own block template, well, who makes a block template? That would be your own node as a miner. Some attempts were made in 2023, I think, to add this part to Bitcoin Core, saying, hey, we've got Stratum V2, why don't you add this to Bitcoin Core and we're all good. For some reason, I ended up taking that over. And then people were like, in Bitcoin Core, were like, oh, that's a lot of extra code. And it's, you know, it's opening a network port and it's speaking this new P2P protocol that might, you know, would need fuzzers and could have bugs. So maybe don't do that. And then we kind of came up with a compromise of saying, okay, Bitcoin Core is not going to speak Stratum V2 itself, but it will speak this new IPC protocol with messages that are exactly what Stratum V2 needs. But then Stratum V2 makes its own little sidecar app that connects to Bitcoin Core and also speaks IPC on the other side. So the Stratum V2 ecosystem is not, so what this IPC mining interface, as we call it, it's not actually a Stratum V2 interface. It is designed around Stratum V2, but it can be used for, you know, Datum or anything else if they wanted to use it too. Or really any, even a legacy style pool could be built on this interface.
Okay, so similar to what you mentioned earlier in that the GUI or wallet could be separated and there would be functions that would essentially connect the two, but it wouldn't be exclusive to necessarily Bitcoin Core's GUI. There could be a different GUI calling those same functions. Similarly, with the mining interface, the initial use case is Stratum V2, but other mining protocols could use those functions as well.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay.
Now, this was mostly done for the V30 release, the initial mining interface design. And then, you know, after V30, especially the people that work on Stratum V2, the SRI team, Stratum Reference Implementation, they started testing it. They found bugs. So we improved things. V31 that came out a bit ago should be a lot more stable. So that's good. And now there's just a couple of extra methods that I think would make the integration even better. And that's kind of where this pull request 34020 comes in, unless you want me to explain something else first.
No, I think you can jump into it.
Okay, so the initial integration was aimed at, Stratum V2 has a couple of different roles. One role that we just talked about is the template provider. The template provider does exactly what you think it does. It provides templates. So it's kind of a natural fit for the node. Then once you are a miner, you have this template. Now, what do you do with it? You declare it to the pool. So there is a role called the job declaration client, job declaration client, JDC, that talks to, you would be shocked about the name, a job declarator server, which is run by the pool. So the client talks to the pool. And so the pool then, the job declarator server, needs to actually check whether the thing you're proposing is valid. Well, it doesn't need to, but it would be kind of foolish if it just started letting you mine completely invalid blocks and paying you for your shares. It's kind of up to the pool. And the best way to verify a block is to really just reconstruct it and then send it to your own node as a miner. As a pool, sorry. So what happens is quite similar to a compact block relay. The miner node creates a list of transaction IDs or witness transaction IDs, transaction witness IDs, sends it off to this job declarator server. It then looks at its own mempool, reconstructs that block. So, and then any transaction it's missing, it will ask the miner, like, hey, give me the full transactions for these because I don't know about them. Once it reconstructs the block, it sends it to the Bitcoin node, and then the node says, it's good. There's no proof of work, but otherwise it's fine. And then the pool can say, okay, dear miner, go ahead and mine on this. This takes a while, and in Stratum V2, miners will optimistically start mining anyway, just assuming it'll be approved. And then if it's rejected for some reason, they'll solo mine or jump to another pool or whatever. The problem in this step is, so far, this is using witness transaction IDs, as I mentioned. And so the job declarator server does not actually have a way to get these from the node right now, because the job declarator server is trying to reconstruct a block. It has these witness IDs, but it doesn't actually know the actual transactions. It needs to get those from the node, but it can't do that because we only have the get raw transaction RPC, and the get raw transaction RPC takes a transaction ID, not a witness transaction ID. So then, you know, it was easy to just add another RPC method, but since we're using IPC anyway for mining, it seemed better to me to just make an IPC method that can get any transaction by either the TXID or the witness ID. And it can get multiple at the same time. It uses this, you know, efficient wire format. And so now with this new method that just got merged and should be available in V32, the job decorator server gets the list of transaction IDs, witness IDs, and then can ask the node for all the actual transactions, reconstruct the block, and then send it to the node for approval.
So previously that was using RPC and now it's using IPC, is that?
No, previously it didn't work at all. So previously what they were doing, I think initially what they were doing is they were calling something like get raw mempool. They would basically just copy everything out of the Bitcoin mempool and have their own sort of fake mempool structure where they could get transactions. And then anything they were missing, they would ask from the miner over the network, and that would, they would add it to their copy of the mempool. So they weren't relying on the node's mempool at all for some things they were. Partially, they were just dumping the whole node mempool. Partially, they were getting missing transactions from miners. I think they quickly changed that design because, like, if you have a 2 gigabyte mempool or something like that, it gets pretty inefficient to start, like, tracking a copy of all of that. So what they ended up doing now is they create a block template themselves, even though they're not mining, they're just checking jobs. They create a block template, and that gives them some idea of what the most relevant transactions are. They put that in their mempool copy. And then they ask whatever's missing to the miners. So it's kind of a workaround. And with this method, they need less of a workaround. And then I recently opened a pull request that essentially would make it even less of a workaround. But we can do that incrementally.
Excellent. It's pretty straightforward. Makes sense to me. Merch, Gustavo, any follow-up questions? Shores, what is the best resource for miners that are curious about Stratum V2, like where would you point them to learn more about, like, how this works, what we just spoke about, but if they want to, you know, pursue Stratum V2 mining?
I would say stratumprotocol.org as one word, or just Google Stratum V2. I think it'll pop up. It's got the whole spec, but it also has get started of like what tooling did you need to install, etc. There's been quite some interesting developments. I don't know if it's listed on this site, but I think there's now an Umbrel app as well, where if you have your own node, you can just install it that way. Some of these node-in-the-box installations. Because I think one of the problems with Stratum V2 is that it started from a spec with all these different roles, it's quite abstract, so it's a little difficult to wrap your head around. But there are now wizards that just tell you, like, okay, do you want a solo mine? Or do you want to mine in a pool? Do you want to make your own templates? If not, and then it kind of gives you all the config files and kind of makes it work for you. But I would start at stratumprotocol.org.
Anything else, Shores, before we wrap up this item?
No, that's all I got.
Okay, great. Thanks for joining us today. You're welcome to hang on for some other newsletter discussion, or we understand if you have things you need to do.
Yes, thank you.
We're going to jump back up to the news section. One item this week titled Using Fountain Codes for IBD. This is a news item based on Lucas's post to Delving Bitcoin. Lucas was unable to join us, so we're going to do our best in sort of translating what the idea is here. Maybe we can outline a bit about what this research is getting at. So obviously you have this full blockchain, several hundred gigabytes, and keeping a full copy is something that not every node runner wants to or can do. So many users run prune nodes, which validate everything but throw away those old blocks. Obviously, then a prune node can't help other nodes sync because it doesn't have those old blocks to serve. So Lucas, who I believe was doing a Vintium fellowship, did some research with a professor down in Brazil. And I think the original idea was from Roast Beef, actually, from the Lightning ecosystem, but also BTCD. And he posted his research on using these things called fountain codes to let prune nodes also contribute to full IBD of other nodes with only a small storage overhead. So I think Lucas uses this metaphor of like droplets. And so you have these little droplets that would be put onto pruned nodes. And then when someone is wanting to sync, doing full IBD, the analogy here is you get all of these droplets, or you connect to many nodes and get many little droplets. You are then a bucket node collecting all these droplets. And that if you get enough of these, you can actually do a full sync, even though all of the different peers you're connecting to might not have a full copy of the blockchain, which is interesting. Maybe I'll pause there. I know there's some technicals we can get into with how that works. Rich, did you get a chance to look at this proposal?
Yeah, I did look at it briefly. So my understanding is that it would require prune nodes that participate in this service to keep a little more storage than usual, but they would essentially take a minuscule cross-section of various block heights. And then when you want to sync, you would reassemble it from all these cross-sections or droplets that people serve you. I think that it got quite a bit of questions and pushback in the thread. So some people were concerned that having a specific set of droplets, and especially if that's individual because you randomly pick parts of every height, would be a perfect fingerprint to re-identify nodes when they change their IP address. The other one is that it would be introducing a bunch of complicated logic to reassemble and to make sure that you have enough of these droplets to get them from way more peers than you would usually need to IBD, and probably would make the IBD slower and more complicated code. So the upside would be, of course, that pruned nodes would have a very easy way of contributing something to IBD. But if there are nodes that have the entire blockchain on hand, they would still be much more efficient. And one commenter also was concerned that the droplet situation would make it more difficult if there were some adversarial behavior where people feed you wrong droplets, and to identify which ones were incorrect and to ban those peers. So I think it's interesting to talk about. I'm not entirely sold at this point.
Yeah, Merch, you touched on some of the concerns raised during the discussion. You need a lot of peers. IBD would be slower. There's fingerprinting risk and also potentially increased denial of service attack surface. You mentioned also potentially malicious nodes. I think that Lucas outlines the different nodes in this architecture as there would be the droplet nodes, which are ones that have validated the chain and they're storing headers and a handful of droplets for each sort of epoch, as he calls them, which is, I think, a collection of 1,000 blocks. So those would essentially be the prune nodes. There'd be the bucket nodes, the ones that are bootstrapping. And then these potentially malicious nodes would be what he calls murky nodes, potentially serving corrupted murky droplets to further this droplet analogy. It's an interesting idea. Yet another approach to IBD, a lot of those being discussed recently. Maybe if there's nothing else, we can outline some of the next steps, at least that Lucas saw, which was, it sounds like he's going to be building a proof of concept in the BTCD node implementation, and potentially also then have a working protocol spec and BIP as next steps as well. Anything else we missed on this news item, Merch, Gustavo, Shores?
I think there was a little, or Shores, go ahead.
Yeah, so as you pointed out, it slows down IBD compared to the ideal situation of having nodes that just have the whole blockchain. But I guess in the longer run, this kind of stuff will be more useful, because if there simply aren't that many nodes that have the full blockchain, then, you know, the best thing you've got is not getting the blockchain. So then it's, you know, that would be your comparison. But I think right now we're nowhere near being short on that. And in principle, you know, as long as you get the headers from a trusted source, I guess you can just get the blocks from Amazon, because you know what the hash is. So it could be one of those things that's interesting but premature.
Pretty much that. So if you already have the header chain, you could BitTorrent the blockchain or something, you know? So while it, of course, sucks if you have to have two pieces of software to achieve one thing, I don't know if currently there's enough demand or need to put this complicated technology into Bitcoin directly. Currently, I think I was going to look it up on Bitnodes. We currently have 21,000 nodes that serve the entire blockchain. So presumably that's kind of enough right now.
Bitcoin Core developer saying you should get your blocks from Amazon. That'll be the headline out of this one. Thanks, Shores.
You are welcome.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is the thing. You have cryptographic proof, sure, via the header chain what exactly the content is in the blockchain byte by byte, because the block headers commit to the entire chain content. Especially once you have the Coinbase transaction that also commits to the witnesses. So, you still need to validate the data, but where you get the data, the worst people can do is that they waste your bandwidth. And if you do validate it and run the right software, if you get your Bitcoin node somewhere strange, then all bets are off, of course.
I think we can jump to the releases and release candidates segment. We have two this week, and we also have Gustavo back. Welcome back, Gustavo.
Hey, guys. Thank you for the intro. Yes, so this week we have two releases. However, ever since we published this new newsletter, two new versions of Bitcoin Core have also been released, which are similar maintenance releases, which we'll cover from next week. But let's talk about version 31.1. This one is a maintenance release that mostly comes with a fix related to the new private broadcast feature. So as we covered in newsletter 409, there was a specific bug edge case where if you were using private broadcast and you had an issue with your V2 transport or version 2 peer-to-peer protocol transport, also known as BIP-324, it would abandon the private connection and broadcast through ClearNet. So now the retry could forget the private broadcast proxy and make a direct IPv4 or IPv6 connection. So now, and if it fails through V2 transport, it will retry on V1 transport as well, but it won't forget the proxy override that private broadcast sets. And that's the main fix, part of 31.1, but there are also other fixes. Another one that is a huge takeaway is that chain-based database compaction. So just Bitcoin Core could randomly start making some chain state changes. Yes, Merge?
So we recently introduced that the UTXO database gets flushed to disk once an hour instead of every 24 hours. So during IBD, it'll flush more often. Usually when the UTXO database runs full, it will flush all the entries to disk and would only do it every 24 hours if it didn't run full. So if your node crashed, you might lose progress on processing the blockchain of up to 24 hours, where your UTXOs would be dirty and you would have to reprocess those roughly maybe 140 blocks. So we recently introduced, I think it was in 29, maybe 30, that instead of flushing every 24 hours, we flush every hour at the latest, but we keep the UTXO database hot. So instead of writing everything to the disk and emptying out the UTXO database, we would keep all the non-dirty UTXOs in the database unless it was full. If it's full, we still flush. But while it's just running every hour, we would only write the dirty UTXOs to disk and keep the, well, we would write all of them, but keep the ones that are still relevant hot. So this means that you don't start overfilling your UTXO database in memory, and you don't lose as much progress if your node crashes unexpectedly. The thing is that previously the so when you write this data to LevelDB, which is how we store the UTXO set on disk, we would sort of defragment the LevelDB. And previously that would happen once per day at most, or even more seldom. I don't exactly know how often. But now with the flush every hour, it would defragment the LevelDB much more often. And that created a significant churn on disk where it would just rewrite large portions of the UTXO set on disk. So that was definitely not intended. Some people reported that they saw a lot more disk I.O. Since this change that was tracked down. And now in 31.1, and I think also the upcoming the releases that are out that we will cover in next week, the 30.3 and 29.4 branches also have these backports. So the chain state compaction runs much more seldomly now. I think it might have been turned off completely in some cases. Sorry, I should have read more into this. But the main takeaway is that the chain state compaction, I think, runs once after IBD and then runs less often, and especially it doesn't write the UTXO set to disk fresh every time it flushes anymore.
Yes, and I think also it's important to specify that there is some like intentional background compaction that is added in this item. So instead of having unpredictable disk activity that was a bit random, this is more, there's now more infrequent, less frequent intentional background compaction. So your database still gets cleaned up. And yeah, so these are the main two items for the version 31.1, but it also has other fixes related to wallet migration. In previous maintenance releases, we covered a bunch of issues related to wallet migration from legacy to disk crypto wallets. So a final small fix was also included in this release, and other small things as well. You can check the release notes for more details. Next is LND version 20.2 beta. This is a maintenance release of LND. So it has a few bug fixes. The first one is something called a DNS fallback panic. So when LND is looking for peers at setup, it will most likely use a DNS seeder for that. And when obtaining DNS records, if a DNS record was missing an SRV or service record, at first it would consider other types of records as a service record, and it would accept it to then later fail it because it would then realize that it was another type of record, such as an A record or a CNAME record. So now during peer discovery, LND doesn't assume that every DNS answered is a service record. It simply validates the DNS record instead of trusting its type. There's also an issue related to the interceptor. So an LND user can optionally set up an HTLC forward interceptor. And there was also an issue related to that. I don't know all the details, but if you were using that, probably worth taking a closer look. And finally, last week we covered in newsletter 412 that LND had tightened the validation of the CLTV expiry of final hop HTLCs. So now that is also part of this maintenance release. That is for the release section, and now we move on to the notable code and documentation section. So this week we have three items from Bitcoin Core and one from three Lightning implementations, Core Lightning, Eclair, and LND. So in Bitcoin Core, at the beginning of the episode, we discussed the third item, which is related to the mining IPC interface. But there are two other important items. So first, 32489 adds a new RPC called Export Watch Only Wallet, which it allows you to, through an RPC call, to export a watch-only version of your wallet, ensuring that it only exports public key material and it doesn't export any private key material, but also it includes your transactions, your labels, and all your other metadata. Previously, you would have to export, to manually export your public descriptions, descriptors, and then when you would import them into another Bitcoin Core node or wallet, you would have to later manually construct such a wallet by importing those public descriptors. So this allows you to easily export a watch-only version of the descriptor wallet to then use and load onto another node if you'd like to sign with air-gapped hardware wallets with external keys. You could use that. You could use that well. Yes, Shorts.
Yeah. So there's a tutorial text file inside the Bitcoin Core repo called multisig-tutorial.md or something like that, and it basically takes you all the way through how to set up a multisig wallet. I think it uses Signet, so you can just try it out without losing your coins. And there's a bunch of really awkward steps in that tutorial where you like have to print all the descriptors and then like write a bash script that imports them again. And it's quite silly. And every time pull requests like this come in, that tutorial just gets less awkward. So this pull request, if you look at it, you'll also see the tutorial getting easier. So I would suggest trying the tutorial.
Thank you so much for that extra context.
Yeah, basically, if you have a wallet with private key material, there was just no good way of producing the public version of that that removes the private key material. You basically had to export the descriptor yourself. You had to then strip the private key material. Or I think there might have been a flag that you could have the descriptor without private key material.
Yeah, you can render the descriptors without private keys. It does that by default. It just shows the XPUBs. But you have to then export the descriptors and then import them again, which is silly.
Right. And I think import descriptor is fairly new too.
If you consider 2019 new, descriptors is actually older than the descriptor wallets themselves.
Okay, I misremember. Thank you for the correction.
Awesome. We move forward with the next item, 32606. So here, the implementation of the compact block relay protocol is updated so that Bitcoin Core ignores compact block messages received from peers in three different scenarios. So basically, the compact block relay protocol works that first peers have to negotiate with a message send compact block. And that message can either make peers agree to send compact blocks unannounced or announced, right? So a peer could request a compact block in the mode zero, let's say, and in the mode one, you're basically signaling to a peer that he can send you compact blocks unannounced. And basically what this item does is that it updates the protocol to first say that you can ignore messages from peers that have not negotiated support at all, or even if you request it, if there's no negotiation at all, you should simply ignore those messages. Or in the high bandwidth announcement mode, which is when you send a block without having a specific compact block, without having a specific request for it, you should ignore the messages if it's sent to you, if you hadn't negotiated that mode, if it's being sent to you in that way. And then also when the local node is running blocks only mode. Yes, Merch?
Sorry, let me jump in there a little bit. So there are two different ways how we transfer blocks. One is the old legacy way where you send a header or even an inventory message first and then send the entire block, including transactions. That hardly gets used anymore by modern Bitcoin Core nodes. The alternative way is to send compact blocks, which are sort of a recipe or a table of contents of what's in the block, basically a set of instructions how to reconstruct the block from the mempool. The idea is that if your node has been online, you should have seen almost all of the transactions that made it into the latest block, and you only need to know which ones to use in what order in order to reconstruct the block. So that was introduced in 2015, is broadly adopted by now. And when nodes make a new peer-to-peer connection, they negotiate features. So the send compact feature indicates, well, having a certain version number in the version handshake tells people whether or not your node should understand the send compact message. And then whether you set 0 or 1 in send compact indicates whether the other peer is chosen as a low bandwidth or a high bandwidth peer. High bandwidth peers are explicitly asked to forward the compact block immediately when they see it, even before validating it. Whereas low bandwidth peers would only announce a compact block announcement after validating the block. And
it's not entirely validating, right? It's not validating. I think it does validate something.
Yeah, sure.
The header, the proof of work in the Merkle tree or something.
Right. But it doesn't do the entire transaction validation and block validation before sending it along. So this fast tracks the block propagation. And we only, Bitcoin Core's default behavior is to tap 3 peers as high bandwidth peers. So these high bandwidth peers would be like the ones that sent them blocks early previously, maybe the first ones to announce blocks to them. The node will go like, hey, you seem like a well-connected node. Please be my high bandwidth peer and just send me compact block announcements immediately when you see them. And so what this pull request does is, if a node didn't negotiate compact block filters at all, aka is running an old protocol version, but then starts sending you compact blocks, do not accept them. If a node was not selected as a high bandwidth peer, but as a low bandwidth peer and sends you a compact block without announcing it, also reject them. And if you're running in blocks only mode, reject any compact block announcements, because if you're in blocks only, you don't have a mempool. Without a mempool, you can't reconstruct compact block announcements. So it doesn't make any sense to send them to you. And the idea or the motivation here is that if you send a compact block announcement, you're sending a table of contents of which transactions are in the block, and the peer will ask back for the transactions they're missing. So you could attack a peer by sending a false compact block announcement that adds more short IDs for transactions that are actually not in the block, and then see which of those transactions your peer asks for to learn which ones they didn't ask for, because those are the ones in the mempool. This is especially dangerous for blocks-only nodes because blocks-only nodes will only have their own transactions in the mempool, transactions that they have announced to peers. So you could use this to glean what nodes have in their mempools. And in order to make that a little more expensive, we reject blocks that shouldn't be coming to, compact block announcements that are coming from peers where we wouldn't expect them.
Perfectly explained. Thank you, Merge.
And is anyone observing the network to see if such gleaning is happening?
I don't think so. There was an issue. So this pull request links to an issue from, I think it was 2015, maybe originally 2023. And I think it's mostly a theoretical issue. But I guess when we're talking about it, we might give people ideas.
The Bitcoin, what is it? The Bitcoin Network Open Collective, BNOC? Maybe some of those folks are looking at that.
Well, hopefully they're not attacking the network, just monitoring it.
I mean, I guess there's not that many people that run a blocks-only node and then also make transactions. So it's probably not a big pond.
Hopefully they would use private broadcast now after 31.1.
And not before?
Well, it was marked experimental, and it had some very specific circumstances under which it failed. But it's all fixed now.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. Also want to say that this is the second improvement to the implementation of Bitcoin Core for compact block relay. In last week's newsletter, we also covered an improvement related to this. So the next item is the one we covered at the beginning. So two new methods are added to the mining IPC interface to obtain, request a list of transactions, either by the transactions ID or the witness transactions ID. So your node, you as a Stratum B2 client, can request those transactions from your node. And this specifically in the case where Pool has obtained a block template from a miner and it is trying to obtain the transactions from its node that the miner has included in its block template. And this is the first step. And if the node wouldn't have some transactions, then the Stratum V2 client could request potentially these transactions to the miner that sent the block template. Next item is from the Core Lightning repository. Here, two PRs, 9104 and 9292. Both of these have implemented the experimental support for the simple close option, which is a new cooperative close protocol. While relatively new, it was merged to the Bolts repository in February 2025. Core Lightning is the third implementation to implement this after Eclair and LND. And briefly, the simple close protocol is different in the sense that instead of both peers having to agree on a specific closing transaction and having to negotiate the fee, which could lead to the closed transaction to get stuck if this agreement would happen, here instead, the simple close avoids this issue by having both peers propose valid closing transactions that both sign for the other, and both of these peers broadcast these transactions independently. So they don't have to agree to a specific fee. Both just propose their transactions, the other signs it, they broadcast, and whichever confirms first is the transaction that closes this channel. So the second PR, 9292, fixes an edge case where Core Lightning where in a situation where an output would be uneconomical to create, a peer could decide to simply create a zero value OP return output. The edge case that was fixed in this second PR is that core lining could at first accept the OP return transaction, but then reject it, which could cause a forced close. So these two PRs together combined are now the represent the experimental implementation for the simple close option, which is a new type of cooperative close transactions. The next item from the Eclair repository is an extension of something that Eclair had already implemented for outgoing HCLCs, and it's now being implemented for incoming HCLCs. Here, the rule is simple. If a CLTV expire is more than 2016 blocks, which is about 2 weeks, then it would be failed. It is not initially rejected. Eclair temporarily accepts the HCLC and then fails it, since rejecting it outright would foreclose the channel. And here the goal, initially the goal is to reduce the risks of funds being locked. That's specifically for outgoing HCLCs. But here the Eclair doesn't want incoming HCLCs with CLTV expires that are too much in the future to consume HCLC slots specifically. So another type of resource could get consumed from Eclair, which is why Eclair has this now strict rule by default. And finally, the last item is from the L&D repository. This is a follow-up to an item we covered in newsletter 410, which started the groundwork for implementing Bolt 12 offers. Here we kind of see the second step to that by adding support for invoice request messages. So first we saw the offer message type in newsletter 410, we covered that. And now we see the invoice request message type being added into L&D. Once again, this is just the groundwork. It doesn't really implement signature verification or checking the invoice request against the corresponding offer. That work is left for subsequent PRs. But we are now seeing the implementation for Bolt 12 offers beginning in the L&D repo. And that is the final item, and that completes the section and the whole newsletter.
Great. Thank you, Gustavo. And Shores, thanks for hanging on and chiming in and for joining us to talk about the mining interface and Stratum V2. Merch, thanks for co-hosting, and thank you all for listening. We'll hear you next week.
Bye-bye.